But we've got ourselves a situation that is very, very, very dangerous for the survival of this republic. And that's not hyperbole, that's real.
Is democracy really on the ballot in Arizona? It's Friday, October 14th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. A little politics and a little music on today's show. Arizona is one of the most closely watched states in next month's midterm elections. We've got some reporting on what's at stake for election laws there. And a little later, some new music for your weekend listening from one of my favorite artists. But first, the January 6th committee has subpoenaed Trump. But if House Democrats were hoping to get answers from the former president about his role in the deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol last year, his response today probably isn't what they had in mind. Deepa Fernandez talked to Representative Zoe Lofgren, a member of the committee, about the subpoena and Trump's response so far.
Congresswoman, Donald Trump issued a response to the subpoena today criticizing your committee's work. His response is reported to be an angry 14-page letter, although 10 of those pages are images. Have you seen the letter?
I just saw the letter. It's a kind of a rant full of untrue things. Actually, the verbiage is a little over 3 pages. Then he's got pictures of his crowd complaining that we didn't show how big his crowd was, and then rehashing various voter fraud allegations, all of which are untrue.
Did he address whether he'll testify?
He did not, we hope that he will.
So if he does, Congresswoman Lofgren, what's the number one question you want to ask him?
Well, we have a lot of questions about what was in his mind. Honestly, if you take a look at this letter and the things that are said that are clearly provably false, you know, some have questioned whether we would get any truth out of him as a witness. But there are some things that we don't yet know about what he was thinking and what we know a lot about what he did and didn't do from other witnesses. But we do think it's not just what can we find out, but I think he needs to be held accountable publicly
Do you worry at all, though, that he might use it as an opportunity just to air more falsehoods about the election, say he's being politically targeted, you know, turn it into a spectacle?
He's going to do that anyhow. He did that in this letter. But we know this and we've proven this. He intended to not comply with the election results before the election. We can prove that. He intended for an armed mob to go to the Capitol to stop the election count. I'd like him to stand up and explain and talk about those actions that we have proven were true.
Now, if he does not comply, how far do you think the committee will take this? Are you prepared to hold him, a former president, in contempt of Congress, like Steve Bannon has been?
Well, we haven't had that discussion. Honestly, he should come in. Other presidents have come in to speak to Congress. I understand that one of his heroes as a president was Teddy Roosevelt. And when Teddy Roosevelt was asked to come to the Congress as a former president, he said former presidents have no more rights than any other citizen. And when they're called, they need to come in. So hopefully he will use that example for himself and just come in. Mm. Now, he does have a history of trying to delay and going to court. We see him doing that with the Department of Justice and the classified document issue. So whether or not there could be litigation, you know, in a timely fashion, I'm not going to go down that road.
Course.
The real issue is he has a responsibility to come in and be accountable for his actions publicly.
Well, the reason I ask about Bannon is because we know he faces jail time for contempt of Congress. Could that happen to a former president?
Well, of course it could. All I'm saying is we have not yet had that discussion.
Okay. So, you know, I wonder if you think that the subpoena will put us any closer as a country to getting accountability and closure for this deadly riot.
Well, we hope it will. It's why we did it. If he comes in and can be publicly accountable for his actions, that would be, I think, a good thing. If he refuses to do that, I think that tells people something else about the former president. He's hiding.
Let's talk about the final report that your committee's working on. You could make a criminal referral to the Department of Justice. Has the committee made a decision on that yet?
Not yet. I mean, the chairman has appointed a subcommittee of the committee, made up of all the lawyers on the committee, to go through, and we'll be doing this in the days to come. It's not going to take too long. And go through all of the evidence we've found that we think merit further investigation for possible prosecution.
And is there more evidence, Congresswoman Lofgren, that we're not getting to see?
Oh, yes. I mean, you have a two-hour, window in a public hearing. You can't possibly show all of the information that has been accumulated. But there are some very serious matters, some of which I think the Department of Justice already knows about, that I think bears further inquiry on that part.
Okay, well, Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, member of the House Select Committee investigating January 6th, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, take care.
The midterms are less than a month away, so right now we're going to stay in the political realm, but get far from Washington. As we heard last week in Wisconsin, one of the top issues in this election is elections themselves. In Arizona, Republicans could overhaul election rules if they prevail in two key races next month. That's after the break. We try to talk to just about everyone with something to say. But sometimes you have to do a story about somebody who doesn't want to talk to you. That's the case in this next one. Peter O'Dowd wanted to ask the Republican running to be Arizona's top election official about election conspiracy theories and his plans to restrict mail-in voting. He wouldn't talk, but Peter got the story anyway, and here it is.
The problem is people who should never have cast a ballot, their ballot being put into the voting machine.
Well, a lot of those went into those boxes.
That's not the machine's fault.
At an Italian restaurant in the town of Fountain Hills, drop boxes and voter fraud were the topic del giorno. The local Republican club meets once a month in the suburb of Phoenix.
No, but they have to get rid of those boxes. I gave up. I don't vote by mail anymore. I go to the polls.
Do you want to order anything from the menu?
Over a glass of wine, Bo James and his friends talk about the upcoming election with a sense of urgency. They were happy to speak with me, even though I crashed their dinner party, and most people around the table said they didn't trust the media.
I love my country, and I see terrible things happening.
Susan Searles says voter security is top of mind. After the 2020 election, she worked the election audit of Maricopa County in Phoenix. You may remember the Republican-led state Senate demanded a hand recount of the vote. It took months to finish.
I worked the audit because I felt like there was fraud, and I think that there was.
But the truth is, there wasn't. The audit confirmed what the courts already had. Joe Biden won the election. Still, his victory rattled Arizona's political landscape, and it lingers here like a heat wave at the end of a long summer. Perhaps no one has cranked up the heat more than a local lawmaker named Mark Fincham.
Ain't gonna be no consistent speech coming from this guy.
Fincham is the Republican candidate for Secretary of State, speaking at a fundraiser in June.
I'm gonna demand a 100% hand count if there is the slightest hint that there's an impropriety.
Fincham allegedly played a role in the effort to create a fake slate of electors that would have helped overturn Biden's victory in Arizona. And wearing his trademark cowboy hat, he was near the steps of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Fincham turned down my request for an interview, but he did tell a conservative podcast that he wants to get rid of voting machines, count votes by hand, and cancel the state's popular mail-in voting system.
Here's what happens. You fill that ballot out, and then you put it in the mail. You have just broken chain of custody. You have just put somebody in between you and the county official who's supposed to be counting your ballot.
At a local PBS debate in September, a moderator asked if he'd have signed off on the 2020 election.
Knowing what we know today, there are certain counties that should have been set aside as irredeemably compromised. Maricopa County was one of them.
And when the moderators asked whether Fincham's winning primary election in August was also flawed?
I have no idea. It is what it is.
What changed? I
mean, what changed?
Yes.
The candidates?
There is a good chance that candidate Fincham will be the state's top election official come January. Democrat Katie Hobbs is leaving the job to run for governor, and several polls show Fincham ahead of his opponent, Adrian Fontes. Chuck Coughlin is a campaign strategist who worked for years to get Republicans elected in Arizona.
It's a clash. It's a complete dichotomy of a choice for the voters of Arizona on how to move forward and how to conduct elections.
Do you think Republicans, the Republican electorate, is buying what Fincham is trying to sell them? I mean, is that what they want in a Secretary of State?
Yeah, I do. I believe that. I believe that Republicans, a vast majority of them, 75, maybe 80% of them, believe that message.
Coughlin isn't one of them. He left the Republican Party when Trump started attacking his former boss, the late Senator John McCain. Coughlin says that if Fincham wins, along with the Trump-endorsed candidate for governor, Kari Lake, his former party will be unrecognizable. Do you see a risk of fundamental changes at the legislature that could undermine the state's election system?
No doubt. I mean, no doubt there will be, if Mr. Fincham is successful and Ms. Lake is successful, there will be bills introduced to eliminate early voting. There will be bills introduced to have the legislature have peremptory authority to overturn the elections if they see something improper. There will be additional scrutiny on voter ID. That's the likely scenario of that.
Can't help but notice we're sitting under a portrait of John McCain. At this point, is it safe to say that John McCain's Arizona, the Republican Party of John McCain, is already gone?
It's still here. It's just not organized under the Republican, the GOP banner.
It is that fear that a new brand of Republican will take control of the state that is motivating Democrats to vote for Fincham's opponent. I met Adrian Fontes at a fundraiser in Tucson, where his supporters sipped beer and picked up yard signs that say, "Save our democracy."
Well, I'm glad you guys are doing this. This is going to help the voters. Good on you. And thanks for knocking doors today, y'all. Keep up the good work.
It's rare for a Secretary of State race to get this much attention, but for Democrats like Mary Kearns, it's clear why the national spotlight is on Arizona. No one can forget the chaos of the 2020 election.
That's what's brought us to this point.
However, the 2020 election, as difficult as it was, it happened the way it was supposed to. You know,
correct.
Democracy prevailed.
Correct.
So do you trust that it will again?
Well, that's one of the reasons I think it's so important that we elect Adrian Fontes as our Secretary of State here in Arizona. Biden only won by about 10,000 votes. The number of precincts in Arizona, that would have been about 4 or 5 votes per precinct statewide. So it's extremely important that we turn out our Democrats and our independents to vote again this year.
And it's true. Fontes can't win in November without support from independents.
We've got ourselves a situation that is very, very, very dangerous for the survival of this republic. And that's not hyperbole, that's real.
Fontes is running on a platform to save Arizona from an election denier. But he carries baggage of his own. Fontes was the Maricopa County recorder in 2020 when he decided to send every Democrat a primary ballot in the mail, whether they asked for one or not. The court put a stop to it. Even the current Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs, said it would have been illegal.
I don't regret it at all. People were afraid to leave their homes. They were afraid of dying. And we have a really good vote-by-mail system. It's not an unusual thing. That's how Arizona works.
You didn't see it would create confusion or people would get a ballot that didn't need one?
I think this is a lot of political bluster brought about by the same group of folks who don't want everyone voting. They believe in voter suppression. And at that time, let's not forget, we were at the beginning of the pandemic. It was an emergency. You know, I'll stand by that decision because I was standing by the voters. And to me, the voters are the most important part of this entire puzzle.
What are the guardrails in place? Let's say, for instance, you were to lose. Mr. Fincham becomes Secretary of State. It's 2024. a Democrat, maybe Joe Biden, maybe another one, wins in Arizona. What guardrails are in place so that the will of the voters is maintained?
Our system wasn't designed for this kind of instability. It wasn't designed for people who don't believe in reality. It is assumed and understood in our Constitution that the officers will duly and faithfully execute the duties of their offices. That goes all the way up to the president and all the way down to dog catcher. Everybody's supposed to just do their job. This is a new era where people are willing to not do their job for some political gain. That's absolutely un-American. It's unheard of. And so we didn't need guardrails because people were going to act with honor. Mr. Fincham has already indicated that he would not act with honor. He's flat out said so. And so what guardrails are there are very limited. You know, there are the courts. We could, you know, battle it out there. But really, the guardrail was American decency. The guardrail was integrity. The guardrails are gone. And now we see the cracks in the system, which we never thought existed before because we couldn't imagine such a monstrous attitude towards our democracy before.
So if the guardrails are gone, what do we do? I mean, do we just rely on different candidates winning elections? Do we change the law?
No, this isn't about the candidates. This is about voters. We have to rely on Americans to save America.
But what if Mark Fincham is exactly what the voters want? Back at the meeting of the Fountain Hills Republicans, Bo James says he believes Joe Biden rightfully won in 2020.
I don't believe the election was stolen. I believe that the voting machines are accurate.
But he's voting for Mark Fincham anyway. James says Fincham is the best choice to keep elections safe. And when I asked if he believes if democracy is on the ballot in November...
I don't believe that. I've heard that too many times. Even with January 6th, democracy prevailed. If there was a insurrection, didn't succeed, democracy prevailed. That's what our system has. Every system, every democratic system has trials and errors, trials and pushback. And democracy prevailed.
There will be another chance to test that theory on November 8th.
Peter O'Dowd there, reporting from Arizona. Head to hearandnow.org for more on that story and subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already to keep up with our election coverage through November. Coming up, I'm taking us on a detour from the news to check out a great new album by Micaiah McCraven. Stick around. A few months ago, I caught a great show here in Chicago. It was the opening night of a new concert venue, the Salt Shed, and the main act was Chicago's own Micaiah McCraven. He's a drummer, composer, and self-described beat scientist who's gotten some attention for his work blending live improvisation with the kind of studio remixing you might expect from a hip-hop producer. Some of McCraven's earlier albums reinterpreted jazz classics from the Blue Note archives and Gil Scott-Heron. But at the Salt Shed, the band, which included longtime collaborators like Junius Paul on bass, Matt Gold on guitar, and Greg Ward on sax, were playing new songs off McCraven's album In These Times. It's a collection of original compositions that he's been refining for years. A few weeks after the show, I caught up with McCraven to talk about the record at his house, which, it's obvious from the moment you enter, is home to a musician. There's a stand-up bass and a piano by the door, and in the living room, where some people might have a TV, there's a trombone.
I mean, I got some like random like trumpets and stuff like that around that I don't really play, but sometimes it's kind of, it's nice. Or in the case it doesn't really work, like a horn or something can also be like a piece of art.
Down in the basement studio, the collection continues. One drum kit is crammed into a side room that the home's previous owners used as a wine cellar.
You know, I got the little rack in there.
Still a wine rack on the wall.
That's how I mount the microphones.
Across the hall is his Wurlitzer electric piano, which he found broken in the basement of a school where he was giving a workshop. He fixed it up, and now you can hear it on some of his albums. Both of McCraven's parents are musicians, too, and he's still got the first instrument they ever gave him, a handmade, fretless electric bass. He's got drums from his dad and brothers, his mom's PA, and other hand-me-downs he's had for years.
Or wooden, it's almost like a balafon, set pieces of a balafon, but that was like hanging up in my home when I was a kid on the wall.
After the home studio tour, we sat down to talk about the new record. It's full of lush instrumentation, strings, horns, a harp, all locked into heavy grooves that McRaven has whittled out of odd meter time signatures. That's part of the meaning of the album's title, he says, In These Times. But it also evokes something more ethereal. It's an instrumental album, but the title track samples Harry Belafonte. Not one of the singer's songs, but an interview he did with the writer and historian Studs Terkel in 1955. They're talking about the black folk hero John Henry, who, the story goes, bested a steam-powered machine in a contest to see who could blast through rock fastest to form a railroad tunnel. Henry's heart gave out after winning. Belafonte quotes something John Henry might have said when he accepted the challenge.
So that I ain't really opposed to the machine. I just feel that the machine can't take the place of the soul and the sweat for the many men who died to help build this tunnel. And we got to finish it, and there just ain't no two ways about it.
On the title track, In These Times, McRaven and his band build up a thunderous rhythm underneath that sample that suddenly gives way to a contemplative melody.
And there just ain't no two ways about it.
What speaks to you about that sample? Like, how did you find it, and why did you want to include it to open the album?
Yeah, well, the idea of progress, following through with progress and those who came before us, you know, and this idea of marching forward through time and through challenges, you know, and I like questions, things that we ponder and think about, you know, even with like the title, like In These Times, and I'd rather it kind of be like a discussion than really a prescription by me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I take your point. The album is, I think that's the only lyrical or the only spoken word on the whole record, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the music. So I think overall it sounds really cohesive, but I think it was recorded in like 5 studios and over 4 live performances or maybe more than that. Talk about how you work kind of blending the line between live and studio. And I'm not even sure sometimes when I'm listening, is this live? Is this overdubbed? How do you work and why do you work that way?
Well, I've always liked working in technology. So, like, even if I'm using live stuff for this and that, I in the recorded realm, I do like to be kind of experimental, say. One of the reasons why I like to record live, there's like a feeling in the room when you're performing for other people. There's a certain energy that I like to just capture. And that doesn't mean I'm like trying to make a live record, but I am really trying to capture the moment and then kind of figure out how to piece it all together.
Let's listen to the track Seventh String. And I love this sound because the instruments all seem to sort of float over the beat. I guess when it comes to writing songs, as a percussionist, do you start with the beat and build up from there, or do you start with the harmony, the melody? I mean, what order do you sort of go in?
I mean, it depends. A lot of the music I write at the piano first. The song comes first, harmony, melody, and that kind of structure. And then you could take a song, you could put a reggae beat to it, you could put a jazz beat to it, you could put it in 5/4, you can do this and that. But then also sometimes I am also writing in other kind of more technological ways where I might be sampling myself or something that happened. And then it's like, okay, well, how do I put this all together? How do I make it cohesive? And then that becomes like, you know, a hurdle. And the hurdle becomes like a space for me to become creative.
I wanted to ask about another track, The Fours. Like a lot of these tracks do, it sort of starts lush, orchestral. you also about all the odd meters on this album. There's a lot of interesting time signatures, and you've just always got a great groove throughout. How do you sort of find a groove in a weird time signature, or does it just come about naturally?
You know, I came up learning my first like odd meter rhythms from my mother, who does a lot of Eastern European folk music, right? And
as a singer,
as a singer and a multi-instrumentalist. She plays different recorders and toured in the group Kalinda out of Hungary. And some of my first gigs with my early band, maybe ninth grade or so, my mom was hiring us to play some like local gigs around town. And she had a lot of music. I was in 5 or 7 or 9, you know. But when my mom was, we didn't count to 7. You played short, short, long, short, short, long, short, short, long, short, short, long. And if you like check out music that's in those rhythms, there are dances associated to them. And so that was a big part of my rhythmic concept, was exploring how rhythm moves people and like explore the different feelings that the time can give us, you know. And like, I think it's just something powerful, you know, that we're dealing with when we're dealing with rhythm. That's definitely a conscious thing that I've tried to develop and was at the very root of like a lot of these compositions. Just about everything in this is in an odd meter except for This Place, That Place, which is all about rhythmic displacement.
Craven's been reworking This Place, That Place with live bands for years, and audiences across the US and Europe will get the chance to hear it on his new tour, which kicks off tomorrow. They'll also likely hear this one. It's called Dream Another. The Craven said he started writing Dream Another on the side, not thinking it would make the new album, but that it just felt right. And like a lot of his work, it grew organically into something beautiful. This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. If you like anything you've heard on Here and Now anytime, we'd love it if you told a friend about us. And even better, you could review us on iTunes and Spotify. It really helps the show grow. And head to hereandnow.org for more about the stories you heard on today's show. We've got photos, videos, links, and even more great stuff that didn't make it into today's episode. For instance, TV critic Eric Deggans weighs in on Netflix's dramatization of the serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer.
Dahmer targeted gay men, particularly gay men of color. And it's long been thought that one reason why he was able to get away with what he did for so long is because police and law enforcement and official institutions didn't have a lot of regard for the people who were his victims.
Today's stories were produced by me, Jill Ryan, and Peter O'Dowd. Jill also edited the show, along with Todd Munt, Tinku Ray, and Chico Theori. Our technical directors are Caleb Green and Patrick O'Connor. Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and I wrote the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone.